This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March 8, 2021. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, broadcasting again here from Phoenix as we get ourselves a little bit further into the month of March, heading up on our first tax season big deadline, the pass-through deadline of March 15th, and getting ourselves for all those wonderful extensions for the pass-throughs for the next week. Good news is they normally don't owe tax. I guess S-corporations could. But this one's a little lower stress because it's not really as big a deal on figuring out what they should be paying in. The next one becomes a much bigger deal. As we all know, the ones that come up in April, well, those tend to have tax liabilities that are going to go with them. But we're going to work on what we have now. And we're going to talk about some of the things that happened this week. And I want to talk about some of them I don't really have a lot in terms of current. In fact, a big thing right now is I don't have a lot in terms of current detail. We'll talk about it, give you some references here. But I don't have an article on them because they're not going to be around too long. Or at least one of them's not going to. The other one's going to be revised, so we're going to need more. The first thing that happened this week is, even though we're less than a month from the end, apparently, of being able to get draws under the program, the SBA this week issued brand new guidance on the Paycheck Protection Program loan issuing process, implementing what the president had told us a week ago was going to be the changes to the program, and we'll discuss some of what's in their guidance. They also gave us a little bit of clarification about that issue that's driven us batty from day one, which has always been, you know, the certification that we need access for the loan in order to, because of uncertainty about our future. We'll talk about how that applies to the second draw loans. And generally, it's good news for those who qualify for it. So we'll talk about that. We also have, in essence, a Senate passed a brand new COVID relief bill, not brand new, but they passed their version of it, that now will have to go to the House to see if the House wants to pick it up or if we're going to conference. You know, will the House just pass the Senate version, which is the quickest way to get this thing into law, or will we go to a conference committee and then have to re-vote? We'll see what happens with that. I am told we are going to, the House is going to take it up on Tuesday. So in theory, we might have a new tax law by the end of next week. In fact, that theory probably is supposed to hold because the goal is here to get this passed by March 14th, and that's because on the 14th of March, the extra unemployment money runs out. And one of the things this bill will do is extend that through September, as I recall, when we got the final compromise out of the Senate bill. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about what they're going to be doing, and we'll talk about the fact the Senate just added something that is going to complicate some already completed returns, that is making unemployment compensation not taxable for those below a certain income level. We'll also talk about today, the IRS continued to clarify, we'll use that term in quotes, the virtual currency question on Form 1040. And then finally, we're going to talk about the IRS gave us guidance on the interaction of the PPP loan forgiveness and the 2020 version of the Employee Retention Credit. There's good news and bad news in what the IRS gave us on this. And it does make a big difference in terms of helping our clients plan. Those who have not yet applied for their forgiveness, you need to make sure that they do it right in order to be able to potentially maximize their 2020 Employee Retention Credit claim for refund that they may very well qualify for. So we'll talk a bit about that. Well, let's start with talking about what happened this week in terms of the PPP loan program. The SBA issued new interim final rules. They are RIN 3245-A867, and they updated their FAQ, the main one, not the forgiveness FAQ, but the main FAQ for PPP loans. And this clarified how the changes in the program are going to work, plus also tells us about some of the other things that will be happening. The first thing that happened here was, we remember last week the president told us in that memo that we were going to be getting a change in the program, which was going to, and turns out exactly what it did. I thought from the beginning, this is what he was referring to. We are going to get a, sole proprietors will get the same basic deal that farmers got. Meaning that if you're a sole proprietor, for your income, for your payroll, you know, your payroll equivalent, instead of using your net income, you can use your gross income. Now, again, that makes no difference if your net was over $100,000, because $100,000 is still that annualized $100,000 is still the limit. So we're going to only get $20,833 for the proprietor, regardless of what they earned. It'd be the maximum. But it will make it better for individuals that met, especially low margin businesses, where there was a significant amount of gross revenue, but not a lot of net. And this will allow them to claim a higher loan. And it could be significantly higher. Now, with good news comes bad news. And the SBA clarified, and the AICPA is complaining about this now, that, well, but if you already got your loan, so let's say you applied right away, as soon as they opened up, you went, you got your second draw loan, you applied for it right away, and you got awarded it based on, you know, whatever, your $50,000 of net income. So you only got, you know, $10,000-some in your loan. That's all you're going to get. You cannot reopen an already issued loan. If the loan has already been issued and funded, you can't pull it back. They do allow you to pull it back pretty much before that date. So if you have an application in process, you could pull it back and reapply for a larger loan based on gross revenue. But if you've already received your loan money for the second draw, tough luck. You're not going to be able to go back in with second draw and get another extra disbursement. AICPA is complaining about that. My guess is, though, Congress has got enough on their hands right now trying to get this reconciliation bill through. And I doubt they're going to want to try to add more things to the bill at this late date. Again, remember, they are dealing with a very narrow margin in the Senate. So I don't think we're going to see it extended unless there is a bipartisan buy-in on extending the March 31st date into the future. And it's not clear if we'll have that. I think that that's really open question. And finally, the FAQ they issued. So they updated, they added a bunch of extra questions on the FAQ, but they went back and added to question 46, if I got my numbers right. That was one that we talked a lot about last year when it came out. And that was the one, the kind of development over time about that question of, do you actually need the loan? You know, is the loan necessary for your continued operation? And remember, we went through the entire Ruth Chris pot or Potbelly Subs and Shake Shack situation. And we had Marco Rubio telling us he was going to haul people in front of the committee because you didn't need the loan, you shouldn't be doing it, all those sorts of things. So all of that went on last year. And then after all of that yelling and screaming, eventually the SBA found that now people weren't applying because they were just, they probably needed it, but they didn't want to try to worry about, you know, would they be deemed to need it? So then they said, okay, anybody with less than $2 million is automatically deemed to need the loan. So we're not going to ask that question. You're deemed to have shown a need, you know, reasonably expected you might need the loan. Now the SBA is going on and telling us how this applies to the second draw loan. And effectively in the FAQ, they tell us that in the second draw loan, because you have to show the decrease in revenue, you have to show that your revenue is down 25% from last year. Because you have to show that decrease in revenue, they're saying that in and of itself proves the need. So that decrease in revenue means that effectively, even though you have to still make that certification, it's essentially a non-event as long as you properly figured out that you had a drop in revenue. Now, if your revenue didn't drop, well, you've got other problems anyway. But in theory, that's what they're going to do. So again, that question, some people were concerned about that, saying, well, I had a drop of 25% in the second quarter last year, but I really didn't have it that bad the rest of the year. And we actually came really close to 2019's numbers, you know, once we got past the reaction in the second quarter. We all remember, you know, as soon as we got the COVID call last year, things got a little messy and a lot of people got, you know, things happened and it became very difficult for a while to work, and some businesses were kind of shut down or people weren't going. Eventually they came back up and running. So bottom line, yeah, even those businesses appear to be okay under this rule. So in any event, we have that going for us. Next up, let's talk about what the Senate did to the American Rescue Plan of 2021. It was on March the 6th, when I'm recording on the 6th, it did pass out of the Senate by a vote of 50 to 49. There was apparently one Republican absent, so the vice president did not have to cast the deciding vote, but it was a party line vote of the 99 senators there. All of the Democrats voted in favor, all the Republicans voted against, so it's a party line bill, which is not all that surprising for anything that goes through the process for reconciliation, because that kind of is how the main bills appear to be going through these days, that are when a new party gets power, they're going to use reconciliation to get the bills through the Senate. That's just the norm. It has some quirks, but we work with it. Now, the big thing the Senate did, though, was they made some changes, but in the tax arena, the big change they made in taxes is they are going to make up to $10,200 of unemployment compensation not subject to tax in the 2020 return. And yes, I did say 2020. That means that the returns that have been filed to date that show unemployment that are eligible for this, we'll talk about who's eligible, they will probably need to amend the return in order to get the refund back. So there will be some amended return issues that will float out here. I was asked today, is it possible the IRS may automate the refunds? Anything's possible, but I have a feeling the IRS is going to have to be issuing those checks again. And because the check system is going to be in there, supposedly what we're going to find now is I'm going to bet that we are going to instead see the need to file amended returns. I was also asked, had anybody ever seen, a change in the tax law this late that was retroactive, into the prior year? And yes, although probably this will be a couple of days later than that. But on March 7th, 2002, that was when bonus depreciation was added to the tax law. And that was specifically added to deal with the economic impact of the 9/11 attacks in 2001. They finally cut a deal in March of 2002 to retroactively make that change. And yes, I do remember all the amended returns to go back and fix the depreciation to get the numbers that we wanted. I would say that may be a possibility here. We'll have to keep our eyes on it. I will also warn you, if this House does not simply vote in favor of the bill and they want to go to conference, it could get interesting and the bill may not go through because they don't have any votes to give in the Senate. I have a feeling there will try to be some sales on the idea that, look, we got the Senate to vote for this. If we go to conference, we have to send it back over there. And if we lose one person, we're sunk. So we need to, just accept what you got and go forward. And we'll just have to deal with anything else otherwise. My guess is that's probably how they'll deal with it. It's similar to when we saw the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act when it was passed. By the time it was passed, definitely people were aware of the retail glitch, the qualified improvement property drafting error. But the reality was that the margins were so tight that they absolutely did not want to go back and try to vote on it again. Because if they made that change, they'd have to vote on the bill again. That would open everything back up again. We just barely got negotiations done, so we're not doing this. Now, the unemployment has a cap. In essence, it is going to apply only to those with modified AGIs below $150,000 in the current proposal. Now, I'm basing this on what we've seen reported from people who have seen the bill. The bill was not available for posting when I went to record this on Saturday afternoon, early Saturday evening at this point. It's not available, so we're working from that report, and mainly the reporting of Richard Rubin of the Wall Street Journal on Twitter has indicated this, and it's in line with what other people are reporting, so I think it's probably correct. And he did indicate that this is his interpretation based on the language, but so far there's nothing he can link. There was nothing at that point, he said, that he could link to that would let us all take a look at it in detail, because they're still putting all the pieces together. Now, as he noted, it's going to be, the way he reads it, a cliff test. That means you go $1. You have to have modified AGIs of probably $150,000 or less. That means if you have $150,000 and $1, of modified AGI, you will suddenly potentially have $10,200 added to your taxable income. That's going to create some wild marginal rates there right at the edge, depending upon, you know, one piece of income in or out, or, you know, doing things like, well, can we make a deductible IRA contribution that might actually, you know, end up, if we do that, that may end up saving us more money than we're paying out. You know, so maybe it becomes money ahead to throw it to the IRA. So, yeah. And the problem with something like that, though, is that means you would have to get the amendments done, or at least get the contributions to the IRA by April 15th. So that's going to put some pressure on if you have clients that are right near that 150 cutoff point. And the other weird part about the 150 is Richard Rubin was reporting that appears to be it's the same cutoff if you're single or married. So we're going to get another huge marriage penalty apparently out of this, assuming they don't change it. And as I said, I have my doubts about them changing it. This is very much, you know, I'm sure there are glitches, but it's very much like the retail glitch. That's great. Really bad that ended up in the law. But, you know, we absolutely cannot risk going back and voting on this again. So I have a feeling we're going to be stuck with it for a while. Okay, next up, we actually have stuff we have articles on now. The IRS modified their frequently asked questions on virtual currency transactions webpage. And they added a question to it. This is the IRS on March the 2nd came up with this, and they modified question and answer number 5 on their virtual currency page. Now, you all probably have all year taken a look at that question right at the top of the Form 1040 that asks if you bought, sold, or otherwise acquired a financial interest in virtual currency this year, yes or no. Now, seems like, if you think about it for a second, if I go out and buy virtual currency, right? I buy virtual currency. I pay cash, I buy virtual currency. That seems to be the textbook definition of acquiring a financial interest, right? I definitely acquired, I have a financial interest in virtual currency now, and I acquired it because I bought it. That seems obvious. However, the IRS is not really interested in that reporting, even though they worded the question to ask for that. If you may remember, we discussed this earlier, that the initial instructions did have an example that said if you bought at examples of transactions and issues and did say you needed to check the box yes if you had bought the virtual currency, right? That was it. Well, a week later, they published the final version of the 1040 regulations and they got rid of those examples. And in an article that was written up in Tax Notes, an IRS representative, unnamed, had said that, you know, we don't want you answering that question yes if you just bought currency. You know, that for us, that's not really the issue. If you bought currency, that's not really the problem. You don't need to answer that yes. Well, the problem is for most of us was nothing in the instructions said you don't answer it yes. The actual question was not changed on the form. And the answer appears to be, yeah, you acquired it, so it would still be yes. Well, the IRS finally got around on March the 2nd to changing their FAQ. And what the FAQ says now, question 5, the 2020 Form 1040, asks whether at any time during 2020 I received, sold, sent, exchanged, or otherwise acquired any financial interest in any virtual currency. During 2020, I purchased virtual currency with real currency and had no other virtual currency transactions during the year. Must I answer yes to the Form 1040 question? Well, reading the question literally, it seems like, yeah, but that's not what the answer is. The answer says no. If your only transactions involving virtual currency during 2020 were purchases of virtual currency with real currency, you are not required to answer yes to the 1040 question. Okay. Now, that's first thing is it's lousy that it took us till March 4th to get this. The second problem is that that's still quasi-unofficial official guidance. And a problem is because web pages come and go on the IRS. The FAQs on IRS web pages, it's not like when you publish a notice. It's one of these things where it could go away. And you couldn't prove that it had been there before unless you kept a copy and printed out. And my bigger concern is not so much with the IRS doing it, but with, for instance, let's say, you know, we get involved in some litigation, the client does, The other party is claiming that the taxpayer is hiding assets, and they use the fact that you answered this question no when it's very clear that you bought virtual currency. See, they're hiding assets. They answered that question, and certainly I can see how you could easily tell a jury. The question was, did you acquire a financial interest? That seems like, yeah, you did. Why did you answer it no if you weren't trying to hide it? So, yeah, I'm a little concerned. I wish the service would have been a little better about doing this, would have changed the form and changed the question. I think the problem is they can't figure out how to word the question to get what they want instead of, you know, that won't be a question that takes up half the form, but also, you know, doesn't get them answering yes in a ton of cases where they really could care less about the fact you had virtual currency. So we'll see what they do next year about this. I'm just going to warn you, you know, make sure you document, make sure you keep a copy of that FAQ and, you know, print it out, keep a copy. Yes, we probably can find it in the Wayback Machine if we have to. Never on the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine. Yes, they'll keep copies of old web pages. So my guess is we could prove it had been there, at least by using the Wayback Machine, the Internet Archive, establish fairly good evidence that it had been on that page at that date. But I think I would still kind of, you know, get it in paper, or get it, I should say, in PDF, probably for most of us these days, and have it as part of the file to indicate why you answered the question. You didn't answer the question yes. Well, it was based on reliance upon this particular FAQ. And now at the end of this, I want to talk to you briefly. We're going to go over the employee retention credit because we got guidance on it this week. And while we're going to talk about Notice 2021-20 and the interaction, I thought I would do a brief review of the employee retention credit because I think a lot of us kind of ignored it when it was first in the law. So let's talk about that credit. And we're going to talk first about the 2020 version of the credit, following the changes in the law we got in December. And the main change we got in December was that essentially, if we got a PPP loan, we could still get the employee retention credit. We just cannot use the same wages, in essence, for both the PPP loan and for the employee retention credit. And why this is important is your clients could be looking at up to $5,000 in cash per employee if they, you know, if they can meet the requirements, if we get at least $10,000 of wages for that employee paid during a, you know, what I refer to as a distress period. And we'll talk about that first, what sort of distress period is. And that's just my term for it. It's nothing to find the code with that reference. But during a distress period, if we pay them at least 10 grand there, we'll get it. But we have to avoid using those wages for PPP loan forgiveness. And we'll talk about how the IRS tells us how to figure that out retroactively. So bottom line, who qualifies for the employee retention credit? Well, first thing is, in order to be, get this, you've got to be in a distress period. And under the law for the 2020 program, your receipts had to be down in a quarter by more than 50% over the same quarter in 2019. So you compare, and the first quarter barely had ERC, so we're going to kind of ignore that. It was just a few days of ERC. So we'll talk mainly about the second, third, and fourth quarters, because those are also the quarters most likely you're going to see the drops in revenue anyway. The first quarter was before COVID really started becoming a big thing. So while you probably saw drops in the first quarter, it probably wasn't 50%, because it wasn't until March that I think people suddenly set up, took notice, and said, hey, this could be bad, and started, you know, changing their behaviors, which includes things like not going to a restaurant and things like that. But it was after the halfway point of the first quarter is what I'd say. So usually I don't find they got the first quarter, and anyway, it's not that many days then. So you've got that. So you start with the first quarter, you're down over 50% over the same quarter in 2019. And you do that until the quarter after the quarter that your receipts grow to more than 80% of the same quarter in 19, or we hit the end of 2020. So for most businesses that would qualify, they'd probably get the third quarter would see the drop by 50% or more, right? And then we'd be looking at the third and fourth quarters, And if the third quarter didn't get back to over 80% of the third quarter of 2020, then they were going to be with ERC the entire year. That whole last three quarters will all be there. The other way you can get it is you can be in a period of full or partial suspension under a government order related to COVID-19. So, for instance, if your business was ordered to shut down, right? You know, basically, let's say you're a hair salon, and obviously those almost everywhere were ordered to shut down for at least some period during the lockdowns in early part of 2020. And it came up in other cases later in the year. We'd see it in certain locations too, where they had second lockdowns. And we saw those things happen. Well, those would be considered covered periods. So that's a second way to get in. So if you had the 50% drop, you're in. If you have this, you're in. Now, the 50% drop is the better one of the two because the suspension period only works for you while you're shut down. But suspension could work if your revenue really didn't take a hit, but you had a suspension. And it is a full or partial. So it could be, for instance, if you were a McDonald's, we shut down your dine-in, but we can't let you keep your drive-through open. That would be a partial suspension that would still qualify. Now, the covered wages that you get the credit on, it is per employee up to $10,000 in cash wages in 2020, so 50% of that, and healthcare costs are considered part of the cash wages. So the max credit per employee is $5,000, and these costs and the payroll has to be within that distress period. The wage dollars cannot be used for PPP loan forgiveness. That's a key thing that we got in December, right? And if you have more than 100 employees, you can only count amounts you pay for employees who are not performing services. That's also the key issue there. But 100 employees and below, you're able to get a credit for everybody. So for a lot of our clients, our 100 employees or less, we're looking at potentially $5,000 for everybody if they kept everybody on the payroll during the distress period. Now, the IRS is very clear that your distress period, your full or partial suspension, if you are able to operate remotely, you are capable of doing it. They have some really good examples in their FAQs you want to look at what will qualify as a full or partial suspension. They basically have said if you could operate, let's say if a CPA firm was not considered essential, so they had to shut down, so they'd be subject to the suspension. Most of us can operate remotely. Now, they do have some special examples there. If it takes you more than 2 weeks to get up to speed because you weren't ready to go remotely, that could still qualify as a shutdown. It's kind of interesting example they put in the most recent guidance. So we have some examples there. So if you have questions, I definitely would say go into those examples because there's a lot of good clarifying issues there, especially for the full or partial shutdown. Now, how you claim the credit is you have to reduce the payroll tax deposit by the amount of the credit was the way you did it supposedly last year. But remember, last year, if you got a PPP loan, you couldn't claim this credit. So most of our clients who got PPP loans were the ones who were impacted by this and would have otherwise got the ERC. They went and got the loan. Well, they didn't do that, but that's the way you'll do it, and you will do it that way in 2021. So keep that in mind. We'll look at that. If you have a credit in excess of your entire payroll tax deposit, you could get that refunded on Form 7200. Form 941 at the quarter reconciles. The same will be true this year for the periods this year where it's here. And we would have to file now, though, because we just got it for people that got a PPP loan. We are just now able to, hey, they qualify for an ERC to the extent we can find non-forgiveness wages to use. We're going to file 941Xs to get those refunds. And again, $5,000 per employee, it's worth going after. And I think, you know, you may find for some clients it would be a significant number. Now, for 2020, we changed this. For 21, I should say, we changed it. And the red on here is what's changed. Distress period, we kept the standard period of shutdown. So, you know, full or partial suspension is still the same as it was before. But now if your receipts are down by 20% or more over the same quarter in 19 in either the current quarter or your prior quarter. So apparently for the first quarter of 2021, if our receipts in 2020 were down by more than, in the fourth quarter of 2020, we're down more than 20% over the fourth quarter of 19, then we're going to automatically qualify for the first quarter of 2021, I should say. The shutdown rules are still there if you're there. And then on covered wages, it gets interesting. Two big changes. First, instead of $10,000 in wages per year, it's $10,000 per quarter, right? And the credit will be 70%, not 50% of the wages. So that's also a significant change. Still, again, you can't use the wage dollars for PPP loan forgiveness. And now, instead of 100 employees, at which point then you've got to be paying it for an employee who's not currently performing services, now you can take that all the way up to 500 employees. So bigger organizations can get credit for the full amount paid, 70%. So instead of $5,000, remember $10,000 for the full year on all the wages and healthcare costs you paid for them during the distress period, $5,000, 50%, now it'll be 70%, and it's $10,000 per quarter, so potential max of $20,000, $14,000 for the year. And the same thing as before, we do that. One other neat thing, though, is you can obtain an advance payment for the quarter right up front, a check up front, equal to 70% of your average wages from 2019. Now, you'll true this up at the end, right? And you have to have 500 fewer employees to get it, but you could ask for the money up front instead of getting it during the quarter. You have to decide if you want to take that risk because you could have to pay it back, the extra. But you would get cash flow up front if you go for that. So that's involved with this, right? So it makes it kind of interesting that 70% rule the whole thing. Now, the bill that the Senate's considering did not touch the House rule here, which would extend this for a whole, would extend this all the way through the end of 2021. So the ERC would continue through the end of 21 as long as you had a distress period. So that means now instead of $14,000, conceivably, if you had somebody who was in distress for the entire year, they're down 20%, you know, at least until the fourth quarter, they're down 20%. So they could always use prior quarter. They could get $28,000 for employees if they're down. So this one could be very significant. So keep your eye on that. Now, what the IRS did this week was they issued notice 2020-2021. I'm going to quit saying 2020 here shortly. 2021-20. It's always bad this time of year because, you know, you spend all day doing tax work that's for 2020. And you got to keep reminding yourself once you finish your tax work for the day that you're in 2021 right now, not 2020. So the IRS issued notice 2021-20. And one of the big things this does is it takes the FAQs they had on their website for the employee retention credit, and it simply picks that up in whole and drops into the notice, which I already told you about the problem we have with, you know, these FAQs on the website disappearing when we talked about the answer to the question for virtual currency. Now we have it on the record, the IRS position on this in a published in the Internal Revenue Bulletin, that in essence it becomes a permanent record of this. So this is nicer. They moved it there. And they duplicated a lot of what's there, but they added some more details for things that were changed in the law and gave us a few more examples, especially of, you know, what qualifies as a partial suspension. So it was kind of nice. Now, the big issue is this particular notice, they tell us, look, this only governs the 2020 ERC. It does not govern the 2021 changes. That guidance is still to come. So you want to keep your eyes open for the 2021. So right now, this is looking back into 2020, and we're going to be working on the planning. As I said, it has the entire FAQ. Now, let's talk. The real problem we have is, remember, now we can go back and apply for the loan and apply for the ERC for the quarters last year, the second, third, and fourth quarter of last year, because if you qualify for any days in the first quarter, that became a part of your second quarter claim anyway. So I'm going to be looking at potentially making a change to the second, third, and fourth quarter 941. So you're going to file 941Xs for that to claim a refund. Now the question is, how do we handle this whole bit with the PPP loan and wages for forgiveness? And what the IRS decided to do is they took what is probably the only method they had realistically they could follow without having to get in and police the SBA program entirely. They're going to only take a look at the expenses you listed on your PPP forgiveness application. And what I mean by that is you need to be able to, even if, let's take a simple case, because I had people ask me this last year. Look, okay, I took my loan out. I paid 24 weeks worth of wages. I'm way over the PPP loan. Do I really have to go back and find those other expenses, or can I just submit the payroll? And the SBA said in their guidance that you just had to submit the payroll. And even if the bank, even if you submit everything, the bank could stop checking things once they, you know, had enough to get full forgiveness. They could stop checking for other items. So a number of people who are rushing to apply for forgiveness went ahead and simply sent payroll data only. We're going to discover that that is suboptimal, shall we say, under this program. Because what's going to happen here is the PPP loan application is your only reference. So we're going to first start out and assume every wage, and remember, you list details, every wage that makes up the total that you put on that form, those wages are going to be considered to be used for forgiveness. Now, there is a way to recover a chunk of that. You can take a look at the application form, the wages you put there, the other payroll costs like, you know, the retirement plan and the state unemployment that count as payroll costs, but they do not get you ERC. So we could take a look at that. We could then look at our mortgage interest, right, and our other utilities and rents, you know, those things. And now we have the others that were added by the end of the year act. We're applying now retroactively, so we could add those in. So what I can do is I can go back and, based on the universe of wages on that application form, I can attempt to pull out only the minimum amount of wages I need to get forgiveness. If you included enough other expenses on there, that number is probably 60% of the original loan. You always have to have 60% of the loan proceeds as payroll costs in order to get forgiveness. But so you take the 60%, now I start working it down. I'm trying to free up ERC wages. So first thing I do is take the 60% and I reduce it by my retirement funding and my state unemployment, because those both count and they're not eligible for ERC. So I'm using non-ERC. Then I'm going to try to backfill with the first wages I want to put in there are wages that would not qualify for ERC. So I want to look at wages that I paid anybody of more than 10 grand, right? You know, in essence, I paid more than 10 grand of wages during the ERC periods. Well, only 10 grand counts, so don't worry about that. I'm looking for wages paid outside of a distress period because, you know, I may very well have a distress period that doesn't overlap my PPP loan. Obviously, if I have, you know, if the PPP loan took it later, that's probably what we're going to have is our distress period be earlier. Obviously, all the wages before the loan, before we got our loan, will be able to be used for ERC. You'll probably want to consider, you know, if you have any related parties under 51I1, and yeah, let's not get into that discussion about who you can't claim ERC on 51I1. I'm hoping the IRS will eventually clarify that more than they have. The real question there is, okay, I can't claim it if I own 100% of the S-Corp. I can't claim it on my son, right? I can't claim it on my brother, my sister, etc., my father, if I hire them. Okay, good. I understand that. But since it says directly or indirectly owns as is controlling interest in the S-Corp or in the entity, do I have a problem that since my son is deemed to own every share I own, and since my son, I'm my son's father, and like I said, I can't hire my father, does this splashback effect, which almost always is going to occur, does that mean also the control person can't get it? That's been a lot of dispute. I'm not going to settle that dispute here. Just going to tell you we have those issues. But obviously, you know, if I have to use some wages, I'm going to throw those 51I, the ones I know for sure I can't get, the son, the daughter, you know, the parents, the brother, the sister, I'm going to throw those into the mix for PPP forgiveness first. And, you know, and then if I still don't have enough, I need more, I'll probably throw the owner in there too. You know, since I figure out we might lose in a 51I anyway, so let's say we use them and let's free up these other wages. So I could, any ones I don't need, those wages that are in excess of what I need, I can identify, specifically decide what those are and put that forward for my application for the ERC refund, right? And like I said, so that's key. But I cannot add expenses that weren't on the application form. So I can't go back and say, hey, all we did was wages, but I had all these rents and mortgage interest, and I had and all these supplies that were, you know, sort of be perishable that would count during that period. You can't go back and add those on per the IRS guides. It has to be what was on the SBA loan program. So that also means that a couple of things for us to help our clients. First thing, for the 2020 loans, if your client has not yet applied for forgiveness, right, they didn't get the application, you want to talk to them right now and tell them to talk with you before they do the application for forgiveness. We are going to want to throw every expense we can throw on there. We don't want to leave an expense off the application, right? That's not wages. We want to have all of them there looking to give us the most flexibility to choose our, you know, to maximize our ERC wages. So even if you don't need the rent to get forgiveness, you don't need the mortgage interest, you don't need the supplies, put them on there anyway, because that will help us build a cushion that will allow us to not end up using more ERC eligible wages than we have to get our PPP forgiveness, right? Be sure you get, you know, the pension plans in there, all those things, and you have to make sure it's for the right period, but get all that stuff in there. That's going to be crucial. Secondly, we're going to be doing some planning for 2021. While we don't have the guidance yet, we can start guessing. If it is extended for the full year, it gets more interesting with our planning because we may not have a period that's not covered or that our client's not, we're going to have to guess when our client's going to come out of coverage for ERC. That's kind of an issue. So, because what we'd like to do is have a period where they're no longer eligible for ERC that we could just devote to PPP loan proceeds, and that would free up our ERC periods. But if we extend the ERC all the way through the end of December, that won't work so well anymore. So it'll be planning. You need to sit down. Also, I strongly suggest you sit down with the Form 3508, the PPP loan application for forgiveness form. Don't worry about it. I know your client may use the short form, may qualify for other things, but you need to understand the 3508, the main one. Because what you are trying to do is work that form to minimize the wages and still come down in the end to getting full forgiveness. And what you do on that form is you compute three numbers, one of which is you take your wage, your payroll cost divided by 0.6, right? Take that number, you take the original loan, and then you take your total costs, which are payroll and non-payroll costs, reduced by whatever that, you know, your percentage is due to FTE if you have to reduce, and take that, and you get the lowest of the three numbers. As should become clear to you, the payroll, you know, the payroll is going to control that 60% calculation, the one divided by 0.6. So you're at that 60% payroll cost, but again, I'm trying to get non-payroll costs in there, non-ERC payroll costs to max that up first. And then I want to have as much of the other expenses. So even if I have a reduction due to FTE or, you know, to full-time equivalency not working, or I reduced wages, I'm still going to be able to backfill with those other expenses. And that's going to be crucial in applying for forgiveness so that we can then be able to maximize this. Now, what we don't know for sure yet, and the IRS is going to have to tell us this here pretty quick, because we're going to get to the end of March here shortly, you know, do we, you know, are we going to make a commitment on the 941 to which wages we're counting, which we're not? Or is it going to again be one of those things where we can come back after we're done, amend and claim the refund? Now, your client's going to probably want you to do it up front because they'd like to have the money now if they're struggling. But you need to kind of understand the planning here. How do we plan on this? How do we deal with it? And learn about it. I realize it's a lousy time to learn about maximizing it. We've kind of known this has been coming ever since this past end of December. Figure out your maximization strategy and start talking with clients. And certainly if a client does not have to apply for forgiveness before April 15th, I would strongly suggest they don't, so you have time to devote for them with them to make sure their application is set up right so that we can maximize their ERC for last year. And I realize a lot of people don't like doing payroll taxes. I realize they're not what you normally do, but I think you got to assist clients. I don't believe the payroll services are going to be anywhere near adequate in doing this sort of work because it involves not only the ERC, but it also involves understanding the application for forgiveness. Whether we like it or not, we are the people that the clients, you know, we're about probably the only people that the clients can turn to who can actually look across both issues, the loan application forms, the, you know, forgiveness idea, and the payroll tax concepts, and try to work out this maximization. So this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments here for the week of March the 8th, 2021. Current Federal Tax Developments brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state societies. I do keep track of some state societies' connect sites, Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, Illinois to some extent, and Washington. So I'll keep my eye on some of those. So I'll try to answer questions there. I'm going to be watching this week what happens if we do get the new law. The new law does not have nearly the number of tax provisions that earlier versions did, so it's not going to be quite as interesting. But as we say, with the unemployment provision in there, certainly you have clients got unemployment. They're going to be calling you right away to try to figure out how that works. So we hopefully will be able to discuss next week if it does become law by next week. Next week's session, we'll go ahead and we'll talk about what they did. Otherwise, take care. Have a good week. We're going to be starting, this will be the week when we come back here in a week. We'll be on the 15th of March, which is the day for all the extensions. So hopefully you get all your extensions together this week. You're ready for that final push in tax season, and we'll see you then. And next week, we'll talk more about current federal tax developments.